Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, employee-owned and operated, and founded on the principle of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the start of the fall season of Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Before we get into this interview for today, I want to just kind of talk a little bit about something personal happening in my life. The avid Eating Matters listeners may have noticed that I ended last season a tiny bit earlier than usual. As summer was a super busy and exciting time for me, personally and professionally. I recently accepted a position as the head of community and communications at this awesome new startup called Our Harvest. We're a New York-based online farmers market and grocery delivery service connecting consumers to the region's most delicious, nutritious, and sustainably produced foods. I'm super thrilled to be working there and, of course, to be continuing to host this podcast where I get to talk about the ongoing barriers to creating a better food system, how to tackle those challenges, and the incredible people doing this work every day. I just want to reiterate for all of you listening that the views that I express on this show are entirely my own. And I will try to keep the shameless plugs about Our Harvest, which is by far the most exciting and innovative food startup making meaningful changes to our food system today around. So I'm already doing super well on that promise. But okay, so now that I put all that out there, I want to kind of get on to the topic at hand. Today, I'm speaking with Jesse Price, editor-in-chief of Eating Well magazine, which recently published its first annual American Food Heroes Awards. This article highlights and honors 10 individuals tackling the biggest food sustainability and nutrition issues of today, many of whom, I'm delighted to say, have been interviewed in the past right here on Eating Matters. Created to shine a light on the positive changes happening in our food system today, the inaugural awards honors heroes who are working actively to address a diverse set of challenges, from cleaning up fast food to making healthier school lunches. And I'm so very pleased that it has brought Jesse to our show today. Welcome.
Hey, Jenna. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So excited to have you. Okay, so before we dig into the awardees specifically, I wanted to talk about the magazine first. To me, I've always thought of Eating Well as a magazine that focuses mostly on health and nutrition. So I'm wondering if this article on food policy is a bit of a departure for the publication.
Yeah, I mean, you are right. We are all about healthy food. That is very core to our brand. But since the beginning, we have also really focused on what we call origins, meaning where your food comes from, the stories behind it, stories about how that food is produced, and in some cases, food politics, food policy, you know, what's going on, you know, with the USDA, all that sort of stuff. So we have been telling those stories for a long time at Eating Well, but it is definitely less, in some ways, glitzy than the pretty, you know, food pictures, which everyone sort of, you know, flips through the magazine and goes, yum, yeah. I want to eat, you know.
Yes. So. Yeah, I know. Food policy to me is like the most exciting thing, but I feel like I'm a little bit in the minority in that category. But I'm equally super excited to look at delicious pictures, you know, pictures of delicious looking food in a gorgeous magazine.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, there are a lot of beautiful food magazines out there today. And you know, our take on also writing about the stories behind the food and food origins is something that does set us apart a little bit, and we've been doing it for a long time.
Do you think that this article or kind of the this article is reflective, just honoring these people basically is reflective of an overall trend of your readers becoming more interested in policy issues?
Well, I think what it's reflective of is a trend that's going on at large. So I think our readers have always been interested in this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But what's happening is we're finding, holy moly, this is going totally mainstream today. Whereas 10 years ago, I think it was sort of like a small, ardent, you know, bunch of people who were interested in this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Today, I think so many more people are aware of sort of what's going on with food, the important matters, and sort of the whole good food movement, if you will.
What topics, I mean, because the awardees, for instance, ran the gamut, but I'm wondering kind of what topics that you have seen maybe personally in your work that people are particularly drawn to or that you've heard from your readership that they want to see more of?
Well, you know, I mean, I think food waste, for example, is a perfect example of a topic that sort of came out of, you know, it wasn't something we talked about, say, even 5 years ago, mm-hmm. very much. And I sort of started seeing, oh, wow, there's all these really innovative things happening to combat food waste. And there's mm-hmm. these events going on to raise awareness about food waste. And suddenly people were talking about it. So we thought, oh, let's cover this in the magazine. You know, maybe it's a little fringy, but let's cover it. And this is about 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we did our first story, and our readers ranked it. So we have these issue surveys where we, you know, ask readers what they think about stories. They ranked it super high, both in terms of having learned something, but also in terms of changing the way they did things, and just in terms of overall appeal for the article. And that's a topic which, you know, food waste, I think we've continued to cover over the past few years again and again, because there's just so much happening around it, and mm-hmm. people are getting so much more interested in it and aware about it.
Mm, that's great. Okay, so there were 10 people nominated, right? And they really, like I said, ran the gamut from issue areas, you know, from advocacy to industry, from nutrition to sustainability. So super wide range. And I'm wondering what the criteria and process was for determining who is nominated and then eventually selected.
Yeah, so this was really fun to develop this whole thing. You know, we have been talking about doing this probably for about 2.5 years. And, you know, I came up with the idea because I thought, you know, we've been writing about these sorts of people doing really amazing things, mm-hmm. but we've never had this comprehensive list where we said, all right, you know, 2017, here are the 10 leaders that we need to celebrate right now and shed light on what they're doing and, you know, make our readers aware of and honor them, too. And so what we did was we looked at all sorts of other awards programs first. You know, we sort of looked at what was out there, and we went, huh, this is how these guys do it, this is how they do it. And we came up with a system that worked for us and worked for, you know, what we wanted to accomplish. So we sent out a call for nominations, mm-hmm. And we sent it out to a long list of experts, industry experts that we put together. And it was ranged from, you know, professors and scientists to journalists. It was sort of a really spanned a wide spectrum of different people who knew a lot about food. So we sent out this call for nominations, and at the same time, we also put it out on social media. You know, so we put it out on our Twitter feed and on our Facebook, and we just said, hey, you know, we're launching this inaugural list. Please send us your candidates, mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about why you think they deserve it. And that was it. So we got in our nominations. We started doing a ton of digging. I mean, a lot of these people we already were aware of.
Right.
But we wanted, you know, to really dig in and say, okay, we wanted people who were doing something right now, you know, so it was timely. Mm-hmm. And we wanted some people who were having a big impact, right? Mm-hmm. So we write about people who are having an impact right in their, you know, town or in their locality, their smaller sphere all the time. But we wanted these people to be having sort of outsized impacts on food.
Yeah.
So that was part of it. Once we went through, you know, like the whole list and we did all the research on everyone, then we basically sat down, a bunch of our editors and I sat down and just started talking and weeding. And it was many hours and many sessions of going, this person or this person? All right, this person's getting kicked out. and we got it down to 10. And like you said, you know, part of the aim was, you know, this is an editorial list, so that means we get to be the judges, mm-hmm. the judge and jury on it. And it means that, you know, we could make sure that we had a list of 10 people who represented many different aspects of what's going on in food right now. You know, yeah, you could find 10 people all working on better school lunches, and that could be your list, but that wasn't really what we were after. We really wanted this broad array, and I think we got that.
Yeah, absolutely. You certainly did, and I personally think your selections were incredible. I think you really highlighted some people.
Jenna.
Yeah, yeah, I know. You've got the Eating Matters seal of approval.
I love it. I'm going to stamp it on the front of the magazine next issue.
I would love to see that. No, but I think, you know, you highlighted some people who are doing super meaningful, impactful work that maybe hadn't been in the national spotlight as much and deserve to be, and yeah. And we'll talk about some of those individuals in a minute, but I'm wondering if you can you just give us kind of a rundown quickly of those 10 individuals who were selected?
Yeah, sure. So I'll just go through them in an order. So we have our first one is Jose Andres, the chef and owner of Think Food Group in Washington, D.C., and we put him on here. I think this is a particularly 2017 pick because of what he's doing to stand up and fight for immigration reform. And, yeah. You know, 2 years ago, I don't think that would have necessarily been a topic that would have made it onto this list. But it's been so much in the news right now, and it actually has such a huge tie to food, you know, it impacts both, you know, people working in the hospitality industry, mm-hmm. and also it really impacts farm workers.
Yeah.
And that's why I felt like what Jose was doing really made sense to highlight this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then our next one is Betty Wiggins, who I know you want to talk about a little bit more, but Betty is amazing, and we'll get into her a little bit more deeply. But she is a school food guru, and she was in the Detroit school district and absolutely overhauled that school district. And then she just moved down to Houston, so she's just gotten started there. And obviously, they're having a lot of problems this fall down in Houston, so I think she will have her hands totally full.
Yeah, definitely.
On a number of levels.
Definitely.
Our next one is Margo Wooten, and this is like, you know, a real policy wonk.
Yeah.
She works for the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and she is the director of nutrition policy for them. And her big push has been around advocating for getting calorie labeling on menus across the U.S.
Yeah, which has been an ongoing battle.
Yeah. I mean, when we first picked her, we thought that that was going to be enacted this year. It actually was set to be enacted this year. And then the Trump administration put a hold on it at the last minute. So it didn't end up happening. But she is so positive. She's just like, hey, you know, this isn't the first road bump I've had in this fight for menu labeling. You know, this isn't the end of the road here.
Yeah. I mean, and that's been delayed, I think, for even longer. And it's just, this is just one more setback. But I feel like she's ready for the up to the challenge.
Yeah, me too. Then we have Lee DeHaan, and he is a scientist. He's a lead scientist on the Kernza domestication program at the Land Institute in Kansas. So for those of you guys who aren't aware of the Land Institute, the big sort of vision of the Land Institute is to develop perennials so that we're not plowing up our fields every year. So Lee DeHaan has been working on perennial wheat called Kernza, and it is actually being grown now, not just in test plots. It's actually being grown and turned into food on a limited basis, but I think it is going to get bigger and bigger, and it is a huge, huge win that they actually have wheat that can grow and, you know, keep growing this way perennially and not have to be plowed up year after year.
Okay, okay.
And then next one we have is Bren Smith. So Bren is he is something that never existed before. He's not a fisherman. He is not exactly just an aquaculturist. He is a 3DC farmer, and he's growing kelp, and he's also growing shellfish on these 3D aquaculture farms that he has developed. And what's cool about Bren, I think, is that he has not only created this model of how to do it for himself, and he's actively growing the kelp and the shellfish, he's now started a nonprofit to help other farmers use his system and get up and running growing this stuff all along our coast, first on the East Coast, but then also on the West Coast as well.
Yeah. Yeah. His work is super interesting. I'm excited to see it progress.
Me too. I'm very excited. So this year they're just, I think they're launching their first 25 farms, but the vision is for it to be absolutely enormous.
Yeah. So you had two industry people on the list, which I thought was really interesting. And especially as a magazine who has, such a heavy emphasis on kind of food nutrition, I'm wondering if there was some kind of question from your readership as to why representatives from big food and from fast food made this list. So can you tell me a little bit about those two individuals?
Yeah. Okay. So we put on Ron Shaik, the CEO of Panera Bread, and Denise Morrison, the CEO of Campbell's. And that was very purposeful. I believe that there is really great stuff happening in food in all areas. Mm-hmm. And it's happening in big food. It's happening in fast food. There are positive changes happening everywhere. And what I love about both of these, Panera and Campbell's, is that they both are creating food that's really accessible. It's not expensive. It's totally available. Anyone can find it. And I think that is really essential to talk about, because we don't want to just talk about these things that are, inaccessible. Kernza, for example, I think is really cool, this perennial wheat. But, my readers probably aren't going to go out and get a piece of bread baked with Kernza. Mm-hmm. But can they go to Panera? Yeah. And are they going to feel confident that the Panera menu has a clean list of ingredients? Yes, they are, because that's what Ron Shaik is on the list for, mm-hmm. is having implemented his no-no list, which he sort of came out in 2014 and said, okay, here's this list of a couple hundred ingredients that are in our food or could potentially be in our food, and we are going to absolutely scrub every one of our recipes to get them out of our food. And they accomplished that in 2017. To me, that's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think too often the advocacy, there's a very wide... It's important to kind of recognize the good work that everybody's doing that's moving in the right direction overall, which sometimes is difficult to do, especially, for advocates to acknowledge. But
right.
Everyone's...
And I think, everything's not going to be perfect overnight. It's small changes, but mm-hmm. they do make a difference. And, You know, you have to sort of like set a benchmark, and then, you know, in 5 years, in 10 years, look back and you go, wow, oh my gosh, you know,
and eggs
are now cage free in all the fast food chains or whatever it is, you know,
and
all
you
the
need
chicken is now antibiotic free, you know, hopefully we're going to say in a few more years,
hopefully,
stuff
but you,
like that,
you
where,
also need the advocacy community. So I should, you know, it would be remiss if I didn't say you need the advocacy community to continue to make sure that these promises are being met and that there is total transparency on all sides.
Yes, absolutely. Agreed.
That's how to put that in. Okay. So we've got a few more awesome individuals to talk about, but before we get into the rest of it, I just want to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors, but we'll learn more when we come back. Stay tuned.
I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife, Charlie, started Bob's Red Mill almost four decades ago. Today, they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his four children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Jesse Price, editor-in-chief of Eating Well, about the their first annual American Food Heroes Award. And I have to say, I think that was the first time one of our sponsorship drops has scooped the interviewer, so the show. So I hadn't heard that one before, but it was all true and all amazing. And I was going to say, we absolutely have to talk about Bob. Before the break, I was going to say we have to talk about Bob, of Bob's Red Mill, who is a very important and generous supporter of HRN and who was on your list. So, yeah. What else can you tell us about Bob and why he made the list that we didn't just hear about?
Well, honestly, that was the most amazing commercial. Yeah. It really did go over almost everything, you know, all the reasons why we wanted to pick Bob.
There we go.
I mean, I feel like Bob made the list because, it's whole grains, right? And
yeah.
I think just that in and of itself, like, we would not have the amazing availability of all sorts of cool grains if it weren't for Bob. And he's been working on this since the 60s, right?
Yeah.
So that in and of itself is great. But what I love about Bob and, you know, is his I think it's sort of a form of social justice. It's all about treating his workers right. And I think, you know, that's reflected in the fact that he gave his company to his employees.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just I think that's unbelievable. I think he's also been super generous. He's given millions of dollars to research university research programs. So I think, you know, that's obviously also a very big deal. And, you know, Bob's 88 now, so it wasn't anything necessarily that happened in 2017, but it's almost like a lifetime achievement award for Bob, I feel like.
Yeah, yes. And we obviously love him here at HRN and are super grateful of the support of the company. So that was really funny, though. okay, so there's a couple that we haven't talked about, and I think that we should hear a little bit about Lindsay. Do you want to tell us who she is?
Sure. So Lindsay Shute, she is the director, co-founder and director of the National Young Farmers Coalition, which is an advocacy group. And, you know, there's a line in this piece that says, over the next 20 years, as much as two-thirds of American farmland will change hands as older farmers die or retire. So two-thirds of our farmland, that is an enormous number, and that's why the Young Farmers Coalition is so important and Lindsay's work is so important. What she is doing is really advocating for people who want to become farmers and need help getting up and running. So maybe they don't have a family farm that they're inheriting. This group helps them get on land, so it helps them work with land trusts, get actual land, but it also helps them get loans for equipment, for all that stuff they need to get up and running. So
yeah.
I think, you know, that organization is a very cool one, and one, you know, my readers may not have heard about, so I love that they're on the list.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, even more important because the, like, average age of a farmer is, I don't know, late 50s, 60s,
yes.
Early 60s. And so there's this huge kind of upcoming challenge of not a lot of young farmers wanting to do this work. And it's going to be a really big problem for us if we don't kind of find ways to incentivize and encourage the next generation to go into farming, because without farmers, we have no food.
Yeah,
which,
absolutely.
That could be a really big problem. So yeah, so her work is her work is really exciting.
It is very exciting. And that also sort of ties in with the last hero that I don't think we've talked about yet, which is Tim Joseph, who's the founder and CEO of Maple Hill Creamery. And basically, Tim was doing dairy. He decided to go organic. He had some struggles there, and he decided, you know what? Organic is good, but I want to go grass-fed, 100% grass-fed, because his belief is that by really managing your land well and rotating your herd carefully, that you will be improving the land, improving the health of the soil, thereby sequestering carbon in the soil and also reducing the amount of runoff that comes from your land. And so he did this on his farm, and then he started recruiting small farms around New York. So I think he has 100 farms in what he calls his milk shed now. And they are all growing or raising cows, dairy cows, the same way that he is, which is 100% grass and really working to restore the health of the land.
Yeah, I think this was exciting because this is kind of something that this is like representative of a bit of a trend that we've definitely seen take hold in the past, you know, couple of years about this push towards grass-fed and not just in dairy, but also, you know, in general, kind of raising awareness about problems in the meat industry and the need to feed cows what they are biologically meant to eat. So this, I think, was a great ad and somebody who's, you know, representative of the direction that a lot of farmers are moving.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that grass-fed and awareness and interest in it is just, you know, it's getting bigger, but it is about to explode.
Yeah, yes, definitely. Okay, so I want to like circle back to two people that I kind of have some remaining questions about. And the first one was Lee DeHaan. So you talked about how he is developing a perennial variety of wheat and that it's a big win. And I'm wondering kind of why this is, like, and what effect this work could have for the food system moving forward?
Okay, so I'll paint this sort of with a broad brush. So, you know, the huge plains of America back in the day, you know, before white folks got out there, were these really, really rich grasslands, right? Mm-hmm. And they were never plowed up. They weren't farmed. They were just wild grasslands. And there was a lot of nutrients in the soil, and those grasslands retained a lot of water, right? And they also sequestered a lot of carbon. Once we got out there and settled, you know, the plains of the U.S., we started farming them, and we started tilling them. The result of all that tilling is we are releasing carbon, and we're also allowing a lot of water to run off of the land. That's like a gross oversimplification, but mm-hmm. that's the gist of the idea. And the idea that Wes Jackson originally had, who's the founder of the Land Institute and who Lee DeHaan works for, was, hey, let's stop, you know, plowing up all our land and exposing this soil and releasing this carbon. Let's create perennial varieties of grains. And the idea is that they grow all year round. You never have to plow up the land, mm-hmm. And they can grow in combination with one another. And they can just be cut down and harvested, and the plant is still there. It has these really, really long roots. I think the Kernza plant has roots that are something like 10 feet into the ground.
Wow.
And that means that the ground and the soil and the nutrients all stay intact. So I hope that was a good explanation,
yeah,
but
absolutely.
It's a little bit of an oversimplification, but that's the general idea of why a perennial wheatgrass is important.
So does this have anything to do with genetic modification? I know that's like a big buzzword in the field, and people automatically think GMOs are bad, and that's a whole other conversation that we can have. But is this a outcome of genetic modification, the work that he's doing?
No, so it's not. It's hybridized wheat, so it's crossed wheat. You know, they've taken different varieties and crossed them to come up with this variety. It's not genetically modified. They have mapped the genome of the Kernza plant. They are not planning to genetically modify it, but the genome map will let them much more quickly continue to breed it to make it even more successful to grow on a commercial basis.
And then the idea being that this will this wheat will be available, like we were going to start to see this in much more commercially utilized products.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So it is in Patagonia's beer right now. They have a beer called Long Root Ale.
Patagonia Cleverly. Provisions.
And then Cascadian Farms, the cereal company, which mm-hmm. is owned by General Mills, will also have Kernza in one of their cereals, I believe. It may already be out there on the shelves, but they were announcing that last March out at Expo West.
Oh, all right. Look for Kernza.
Yeah.
And then one more question. I want to get back to Betty, and you know, I am from the Detroit area, so I'm a little bit biased and to highlight some of the great people who have done meaningful work there. But can you, you know, I particularly really appreciated to see her, and then just generally a food service director on this list, because so often they tend to be the people that one points to as the reason why school meals can be so unhealthy, despite a system that's basically evolved to all but prevent, you know, being able to feed kids nutritious food. And those who are working actively and tirelessly are often like the unsung heroes of kind of the food system change. So I want to, you know, if you could give us just a little bit more of an overview about some of the work she did in Detroit, you know, and what she kind of hopes to do in Houston, which I understand is a much, much larger school district.
Yeah. So I think Betty is amazing. She seems like she is just a total pragmatist. She tells it like it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's very outspoken.
She does not mess around.
Yeah.
So you know, she went into the Detroit school district, like many of the districts in the U.S. It was not in great shape in terms of the school food programs. She really, really overhauled it. So she made it so that all 57,000 students in the district at 141 schools could get three meals a day, up to three meals a day for free. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
She also put in a lot of school gardens, so 80 school gardens, six hoop houses, and a 2.5-acre production farm within the Detroit city limits.
Wow.
And, you know, what I think is especially cool about her is that she's not, you know, she's not precious. As I said, she's totally pragmatic.
Yeah.
So, she, in Detroit, was working with schools that had totally outdated kitchens that were not set up to cook from scratch. And she said, okay, well, that's all right. We can still put healthy food on the table, even if we're not cooking, you know, all local food, you know, all from scratch. And she said, you know, brown rice, black-eyed peas, frozen vegetables, you know, pre-cooked chicken breasts, that's fine. You know, it may not be perfect, but it's a whole lot better, and it's definitely healthy for these kids.
Yeah. And that's, you know, implementing universal school meals especially is so important. And she did these, she made these changes in a district with not a lot of money. And I think that that just goes to show you. I feel like if you can do it in Detroit, you can do it, you know, almost anywhere, because she certainly
no
had to.
No kidding. I mean, I hope she is successful in Houston. So that school district has 215,000 public school students.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously not the same situation as Detroit in terms of the finances of the city. I assume are much better.
Yes. And like you said, she has her work cut out for her with all of the the Hurricane Harvey and all the rebuilding that has to happen there. Okay, so we've got time for two more questions. And the first I wanted to ask you is, was there anybody who initially you were surprised to see kind of come up on this list and that you were maybe this person?
You know, I did not know most of these people. I kind of knew about. I didn't know about Margot Wooten from the CSPI, Center for Science in the Public Interest.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about her, and she, you know, came whatever. She was nominated, and I started reading about her, and I went, wow, she is really cool, amazing. She's a great example of a sort of a behind-the-scenes advocate who maybe didn't have a big profile, but was doing really important stuff.
Oh, yeah. She's been behind some serious legislation and kind of just public health interventions in general that have really driven the, you know, I would say really made a big strides in our food system and institutionally, that's true as well.
Yeah.
So anyone looking towards the future, because this was the first of hopefully many. There any kind of individuals or who's up and coming, right? Who do you expect to see on the short list for the future? A little sneak peek.
Oh, boy. I don't want to say names for the future. I mean, that would be wrong,
okay,
I feel
okay.
like. But, you know, I mean, now that we've implemented this list, I'm always thinking about it, of course, and my editors are as well. So we have our eyes peeled.
Open
to
suggestions.
As we see what's coming down, you know, what's happening, you know, in what's topical, what's happening right now, I think, you know, that will, of course, influence it. And, you know, we will take nominations. So anyone out there listening, too, is welcome to send us their thoughts and their nominations.
Great. All right. Well, that is so wonderful. We're going to have to leave it there. But I really want to thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so for to read the article, it is in the September-October issue. You can go to eatingwell.com or look for the magazine online or in Barnes & Nobles and Whole Foods. I want to thank once again Jesse Price so much for coming on the show today. I also want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for your generous support. Show music is by Tim Archer, and thank you to our engineer, Vitor Hirscht. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. And if you like what you hear, let us know in the comments section. Always love your feedback. Like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook and find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.